Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Most people know South Central Los Angeles as a scene in a movie, or a line in a hip-hop song, or in the bird's-eye view of a news helicopter. Margaret B. Jones knows South Central from a foster home in the heart of it, from the grandmother and the gang that raised her, from the inside of a young girl's heart, her own heart. Friends and siblings have fallen one by one to gunfire or prison time. Somehow, she made it out alive. This hour, On Point, real life in South Central L.A., and Margaret B. Jones with her moving memoir, Love and Consequences. Have we learned anything beyond Boys in the Hood and hip-hop about the realities of our country's urban war zones, with 1 in 100 American adults now in prison, 1 in 36 Latinos, 1 in 15 Black American adult males? Is it time we listened again? Joining me now from Eugene, Oregon, is Margaret B. Jones. Her new memoir, Love and Consequences, is a really smart, tender, honest account of growing up in South Central L.A. Margaret Jones, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're getting rave reviews for this memoir, and I will add mine. It is remarkable, just a beautiful, direct piece of writing and an angle on this world that I've never quite had the opportunity to see it from before. Could you tell us how you came to live in the 1980s at the height of the crack trade in South Central L.A., Margaret?
Through a foster care system, I got placed in a home down there. You know, when you're little, you don't think about, oh, this is a bad neighborhood, this is a good neighborhood. It's just a neighborhood. It's just another home. I sort of would look at the graffiti, look at different things, and try and get a sense of every different neighborhood, because every neighborhood in L.A. has a very different feel. But it's funny because, like I said, as a child, you really don't see things in that black and white, good and bad.
You were kind of a white ancestry, a Native American as well, really bumped roughly through the foster system. Is our, I don't know, 8 or 9 homes before you ended up at a home in South Central. There had been abuse very early on in your sort of kindergarten life, in your background. And now here you were. I wish you'd describe for us the home and family that took you in South Central.
Well, you know, the house, I think I said in the book, the house looked a little shabbier than other houses, but it was very much a house of love. You know, it was a loving house. You know, Big Mom was very much, she was like everybody's mom. She was one of those people who she just had love for everybody and was concerned about everybody. She could meet you at church and know you for 5 minutes, and you could tell her your problem. She would pray for you every day for a month. I mean, that was just her. She was just one of the most caring people that you could ever in your life meet.
Big Mama, African-American grandmother with 4 other children that she was caring for in this little house in South Central.
Yes. Actually, you know, kids came and went, and I kind of, you have to take that artistic vision. I'd read so many books where there were so many people you couldn't keep track of anybody, and so I kind of focused on main people, but there were other people who came and went, and there were, you know, probably at any given time up to like 8 people.
What do we need to know about the community that you grew up in? What's the essential thing? I mean, you clearly have written this with a sense of mission, that people don't really get what's happening there, that it's a kind of a cliche view, that when people like yourself make it out to tell the story, there's this sort of petting zoo approach to seeing what goes on there and asking someone like yourself about it. What do we most essentially need to know?
You know, that all people are different. You know, you find good and bad people in any area and in any walk of life. People say, well, what's life like for a gang member? I mean, you don't wake up in the morning and say, as a gang member, what am I going to have for breakfast? You know, people are living their lives. There's people who are parents. There's people who go to school. There's people who play sports. There's all different kinds of people. I think people ask me a lot of questions and say things that used to frustrate me, and I learned to sort of step back and not take it personally and understand that if people get all their information from movies like Boys in the Hood, Menace to Society, and off shows like Cops, it's not their fault they don't know.
But you make it clear that there's a lot that people don't know, and you suggest that there's a lot that this country at large just chooses to ignore about what a battle zone this is for many people who live in it. Was in the 1980s and continues to be today, if the headlines are accurate at all.
I think it's worse today. I mean, honestly, that's one of the things we always say. As bad as it was growing up, it's worse now because there's more money tied up in the gangs. There's more money tied up in the drugs. Guns are everywhere. You know, back in the day, you could have a dispute with someone. You would go heads up and they would put you in the street. You would fight each other. At the end of it, you would shake hands. Someone would be a winner. Someone would be a loser. But everybody walked away with their life. Now people just go straight to shooting.
You say that life there is really should be just seen as more like life in an urban third world country. You see, my words and views were learned in the dirt and desolation of South Central Los Angeles. The streets where I grew up were run by the laws of the local gangs. Their laws shaped what we wore, how we talked, how we navigated the city. Give us a sense of that, Margaret Jones. I mean, it comes across powerfully in the book. But this is, I mean, every time you step out the door in the community you grew up in, and even before you're out the door, gang life, gang laws are the law of the land.
Yeah, and you have to think about that. And I laugh now, but back in the day, you know, you'll say, man, the buses are crazy. They don't even worry about whose neighborhood they're going through. They just go any which way. Well, why would a bus worry about whose gang turf it went through? But it is a concern in L.A. You know, you have to mind your color codes. You don't wear the wrong thing in the wrong neighborhood. If you're from a neighborhood, you don't go to the wrong neighborhood. You know, we say you always have to look in your rearview mirror. You always have to look in your rearview mirror. You have to keep a sense of everything that's going on around you. And to this day, I mean, if I go see a movie, I'll go sit in the corner and look at everybody and have three different possible escape plans in mind just in case something pops off.
Tell us about how gang lines wove through your neighborhood, where your family in South Central stood in the sort of gang dynamic, Margaret.
Well, things have changed a lot. I mean, I'll start off saying that the South Central of the late 80s, early 90s was, I must say, 90% black. Now it's something like 70% Hispanic. Mm-hmm. And so gang lines and turfs have really changed. Excuse me. And I'll come out and say, I don't think the blood Crip thing, that's probably not going to last more than 5 more years. Now it's blacks and Hispanics fighting in L.A. And I say that's L.A.'s dirty little secret. And it's a race war like you have never seen. I remember before the Rodney King riots, race relations were bad, and it's nothing compared to today. You can drive through the neighborhoods and you'll see, you know, all kinds of things about, you know, we're going to kill these people or these people, and it's really brutal, and it's like growing up in a war. Now, back in the day, it was more Bloods and Crips, and it really goes by neighborhood. So you have your 40s neighborhood, your 30s neighborhood, your 20s neighborhood, your 60s neighborhood, and the street numbers in L.A. are numbered. So it sort of goes along with that.
So, and in each of those, a different dominant gang or sector of a gang.
Right. And each gang set is going to have little different subsets. Like if you're from 60s, not only are there 60s, there's Sloss in 60s. If you're from 20s, not only are there 20s, but there's 27th Street family, 29th Street family, there's Belize in 20s. So there's going to be all different things. If you're from Black Pea Stones, there's City Stones and Jungle Stones, and the Jungle Stones live in the projects, and the City Stones live over by 2nd Avenue Park. So the gangs are huge. You do have a couple areas, like from the 20s, you have 20s right next to another blood set, next to another blood set. So they'll have like 5-mile radius. And then the 30s and 40s are both Crips. So you have, you know, another 5-mile radius where it's solid Bloods or solid Crips. But like I said, that's not true so much anymore because now you have all these really big, powerful Hispanic gangs like 18th Street and MS-13, Sereno 13, and they're battling for the same neighborhoods.
Would you describe for us how your older foster brother, stepbrother Terrell was, I don't know what the right word is, inducted into the Bloods?
Yeah, we call it jumped in. It's different neighborhood to neighborhood. In my particular neighborhood that we were in, it was, you know, 5 people beat you for 2 minutes in the street. And the theory behind that, it sounds really brutal, but the theory is your homeboys, they might send you to the hospital, but they're not going to kill you. And if you can't stand up and be a man and take it knowing that they won't kill you, what are you going to do when the enemies do it?
How old was Terrell when he got jumped in, beaten hard for 2 minutes by grown men?
12. That's about the norm, though. 12, 13 is about the norm. Some people come in a little younger. Some people come in a little older. But if you've made it to like 15, 16 without joining a gang, you probably aren't going to join a gang.
And when it was over, he was a Blood. He was a member of the Blood Gang.
Yeah, that's how it works.
And Big Mama, remind us how she took that.
Well, she didn't like it. It's not what you want for your kids, but you have to understand that gangs recruit like the NFL. You know, they go through the hood, and this person is obviously without a father. You know, he's at the park all the time hanging out. This person gets in fights and wins, so he's pretty strong. We'll probably try and take this person, try and get this person. You know, they're very strategic about it. So by the time you're coming in, it's not something that your parents can stop, no matter how much they love you. I mean, the call of the streets is really strong, and you're growing up in a community that there's mass unemployment, you know, there's mass poverty, there's not resources. And when you look around and the only people who are looking like they're doing well are doing that, and when you know you can make $1,200 on the street in a day and you see other people working 2-3 jobs just to get by, I mean, as a kid, you don't always make the best choices. You go with what seems easy. You go with what looks good. I knew I was gonna be something from the hood, Hollywood to the big screen. I knew I was gonna be something from the bus stop bucket to a Bentley.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about growing up in the gang land of South Central L.A., getting a girl's eye view of the brutality and tenderness of a very tough world. Margaret B. Jones joins me from Eugene, Oregon, where she now lives in a nice little bungalow with a daughter a long way from South Central, but she's still tied in a million ways in her new memoir, Love and Consequences. Will take you there like you may never quite have been there before. It's very direct. It's very intimate. It is a very revealing and beautifully written memoir of growing up in a foster home in the middle of South Central. Do we really acknowledge our urban war zones or package them up in pop music and treat them like cartoons? Do you know these streets in L.A., in Newark, Boston, Chicago? Have you ever thought past the gunfire and crack vials to the rest of life in these neighborhoods, the coping and recovering, the meal times and bath times and love? Marlene is calling from Medford, Massachusetts. Marlene, you're on the air with Margaret B. Jones.
Yes, I'm very sorry about such a situation. In the last 5 years of this war we've had in Iraq, we've lost over 4,000 young soldiers, American soldiers. But in the last same 5 years here within our country, we have lost about 151,000 people from guns. No other country has this kind of record at all, Tom, because there are difficult young people in all countries, like in England and in European countries, too. There are a lot of troublesome youth, and they don't know what to do with their lives, and they do damage, but they cannot get hold of guns. We're the only country in the world where they can get hold of guns so easily.
Mm. Marlene, thanks for your call. Margaret Jones, how did it, how does it look to you? Is it the trunks full of guns everywhere that are the problem, or something else?
I mean, it is a problem. I always tell people, gangs are not the problem. Gangs are a symptom of the problem. And I think it's real important to say that. At the same time, that's not a lie. If you've got $150, you can go get a gun. You know, no waiting period, no nothing, just on the street to go get a gun. And they shouldn't be that accessible.
You write, America wraps itself in the idea that the problem with the ghetto is that its inhabitants are lazy hoodlums. It builds walls around the problem, both figurative and real, and gets on with its life. Luxury, then, you quote Amiri Bakara, is a way of being ignorant comfortably.
Wow. I think that's really true. I mean, I'm from a city where to build a building, you need to get approval from the police department. I read someplace that healing L.A. is, or building L.A. is like padding the bunkers. You know, they do this abatement thing where they contain everything crime-wise and violence-wise to the urban core, and then they sort of use abatement zones on the outside, you know, Koreatown, to keep everybody else safe. So we grow up in this little wasteland where no one cares about us. Public policy doesn't really apply to us, and we're literally dying every day, and nobody has to see it. The L.A. Times has a Valley edition and a City edition. I mean, we don't even share a newspaper.
Margaret, I want to be sure that people have a sense of you and how you arrived where you were. You described your foster brother, Terrell, being jumped in or beaten in, sort of broken into the Bloods But by the time you arrived here, you describe vividly in the book how in many ways you were jumped in by life yourself, by what had happened in your own organic family, by what had happened in all the foster families. What had been sort of beaten out of you by the time you arrived in South Central as a child of the L.A. foster system?
Well, I'll say that, and I got this from one of the OGs from the neighborhood, but
OG is an old gangster, sort of senior gang member.
Right. If you're in an army and you're in a gang and they're the same thing, a OG would be like the general. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they say that he had said joining a gang is like joining a Palestinian suicide bombing group. A logical person could never understand. But when you're young and you're looking for a sense of identity, you're looking for a family, you're looking for something to belong to, and you have that void and that emptiness inside of you that you need to fill, it makes perfect sense. You know, it gives you something where you can rise up through the ranks and be proud of yourself. It gives you a community, a family, people who care about you, people who, if someone comes after you, they're going to go after them. And that's a real powerful thing to a kid, especially a kid who doesn't have that sense of security somewhere else.
And an original gangster, OG, maybe to look up to along the way. What was it that you had lost by the time you got there?
I don't know. I don't know if I could say it's any one concrete thing. I mean, definitely there was instability, you know, and if you join a gang, it's definitely something you do for life. So that's appealing. You know, that's people who will have your back for the rest of your life. If you're not growing up with a stable family, you don't know where you're going to get bounced to. You don't know what's going on with you. That looks good.
Your original gangster, your OG, or one of an early one was a man named Crazyak. Tell us about him and what you did for him in the gang world.
I made drug deliveries for him. That's what you have kids doing in L.A.
You were 12 years old or so at the time?
Yeah, when they have kids do that for a reason. They have them do that because drug laws are so harsh that if they get caught, they're going to go do a big chunk of time. But a kid's going to go do a couple years of juvie and get back out. And the kids want to do it. I mean, the kids are going to earn respect by doing it.
You were 12 years old, and what, you would sort of be out on the street if someone appeared to be in the market for drugs, they'd approach you or you'd approach them, sort of check them out and give the sign if it looked good.
Yeah, that's what we call a runner. And you just sort of check everybody else out, give them the heads up. Okay, you go here, you go here. You're sort of basically directing traffic.
You were 12, though. Was that common to be that young doing that work?
You know, it's funny. I had a great editor at Riverhead. And she'd say 12. I mean, it's just so hard for me to wrap my head around that because in the rest of the country, 12-year-olds are playing with G.I. Joe action figures. And I was thinking, let someone play with one of those in the hood, 12 years old. They get whooped on. That's baby stuff. So I think it's just a whole different perspective. For us, 12 is older.
And you would take home money that could make a real difference, and then came a bad day when a car pulled up. You saw it early on. It became clear that these were not Bloods. These were not neighborhood guys. The gunfire began. What happened?
On that day, that was the day the big homie got shot.
As in your OG, Crazyak.
Yeah. I'll read a passage from the book. It says, "One of the OGs went by the name of Crazyak. He was in his early 30s, light-skinned, with long hair that he kept in meticulous braids. Every week he had them freshly done in elaborate designs. He drove a candy red 1969 Chevy Chevelle Malibu Supersport with two black racing stripes up the middle and a red bandana neatly folded and tied around the rearview mirror. From the stories Crazyak told, it seemed as though he'd been around almost as long as the hood itself. He knew everything about L.A.'s history, not only the history of our gang's conception, but that of all gangs. He told us about the Purple Hearts, the Swassons, the gangs that preceded Bloods and Crips, how they had formed in the 40s and 50s to protect the community against rampant racial violence."
And then came this incredible burst of gunfire. You're right there in the middle of it. You finally see what happened, and it was the death of Crazyak. You saw blood coming out of him every which way. He went off, never to return. He died. And you write about you as a 12-year-old girl sort of standing there contemplating that and then shuffling home. I wish you'd read that as well, if you would, Margaret.
Okay. "My foster mom liked for all the girls in the house to wear braids. She said they looked neat, and she didn't want us running around looking like ragamuffins. Because her long hours scrubbing floors and Wallace left her fingers stiff, and because I was the oldest girl, I would braid my foster sister's hair for her. When I was done with them, Big Mom would do mine. It always came out in embarrassingly crooked, loose cornrows, made even worse by the fact that, though thick and wavy, my hair didn't really have the texture to hold it. I killed a lot of time on the job unbraiding my hair and daydreaming about shoes and things I was going to buy for myself and my two little foster sisters. I loved the thought that thanks to my after-school activities, my girls wouldn't be teased for wearing hand-me-downs like I had in elementary school. Things were only going to get better. The sky's the limit, Crazy Ack would tell me as he handed me my cut of the money we made, usually giving me an extra 20 off the top as a reward for my good work.
Crazy Ack, the boss who died, I want you to go right on, if you would, to that moment after the killing where the blood is everywhere. You've been one of the older guys there, brings out a bottle of Hennessy to kind of calm everyone down, pours you some as a 12-year-old and some Pepsi. You're standing there looking at what's going on. Could you read that for us, Margaret?
I stood for a moment looking at the flies as they circled around the dried blood, landing and taking off over and over again in the day's last light. Then, eyes downcast, I started shuffling home. My foster sisters would be sitting on the sofa, watching cartoons and waiting for dinner. Red beans or black-eyed peas, most likely. I knew Big Mom would make me set the table, and then give me a whooping and send me to my room for coming home late. It didn't matter, though. I didn't want to sit at the table and listen to how everyone's day was, or have Big Mom ask me what I learned in school. I sipped the rest of the Pepsi and then threw the cup into the street. As I watched it, a glint of light caught my eye and I bent down and pinched a bullet shell between my fingers, rolling it back and forth a few times before slipping it into my jeans. The whole walk home, I kept the shell clenched tightly in my fist inside my pocket.
Margaret B. Jones, reading from her new memoir, Love and Consequences. You know, running drugs, watching her kind of a mentor be shot down in the street and then going home to set the table. Wow. 800-423-8255 is our number. Jack is calling from Boston. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing today?
Very well, thanks.
I'm calling today because I grew up in the lower south in Louisiana during the 80s. Mm-hmm. And many of my relatives had moved to California, and you know, when they went out, they told us about some of the things they saw happening. And as they returned, their kids who were coming back to Louisiana, they started bringing over some of the concepts, some of the ideas that they learned, you know, when they were in that area. And so seeing it firsthand, seeing the, you know, the buildup of the Bloods and the Crips and the, you know, the P-Rolls and the Grape Street, you know, happening in Louisiana, it kind of changed my perspective of what was happening.
Jack, did you see it as a white man, as a black man, as a gang member or not?
As a black man, non-gang member.
Mm-hmm.
But I did start seeing the recruitment. What happened was, as more of these people went out west and they would stay for a short amount of time, they return, and it's similar to what, you know, you've heard of MS-13. They go over to these areas and there's really not much success in that environment. But when they return back to their home places, they're looked at as being kings, as being the OGs, as being the people who survived, you know, the gang life in California. So they started recruiting people. And what I saw for myself was that, you know, people in my neighborhood who I've grown up to, you start to idealize these persons and you wanted to be just mm-hmm. like them. But fortunately for me, many of these kids saw that there was potential outside of the gang. And I wanted to know from Ms. Jones, you know, being a young lady and being able to reach this level of success that she has, you know, what advice does she have, you know, for children, you know, to see these things happening, but know that there's other options available to them. And what can she say to the people who can make the difference? You know, is there a better way to utilize the monies and the resources to prevent more of these kids from falling prey to, you know, to the glamorized view of what gang life is like?
Jack, we'll put that to Margaret Jones, but let me ask you, while I've got you, a black man who has seen relatives go west, join gangs, come back, and all the rest, and I'm looking at the news story that just came out yesterday. It's in the papers this morning. 1 in 15 adult black men in the United States incarcerated. 1 in 9 black men between ages 20 and 34. I mean, those are quite incredible numbers. What do you think when you hear that, Jack?
It makes me upset. Makes me very upset, especially, you know, with this being 2008 and all of the talk now is that race relations are better and that, you know, they're talking about the economy is going into a recession, but there's been a recession in the black community, you know, since as far as you can remember. So for the black people in America, you know, we're hearing recession coming across, you know, the airways, and, you know, though I'm not trying to make it a racial point, many of the people who haven't lived this type of lifestyle, this is something new to them. But for us, you know, the majority of the people that I know, we grew up impoverished. We grew up in areas where, you know, if you were able to, you know, to have money to buy milk, but you couldn't pay for your electric bill, well, you're going to buy the milk. You know, we've gone through the times where you had no heat, so you have your stove running because you have at least, you know, you have gas coming from your stove. Mm-hmm. And you had no running water, so you would go to your neighbor's houses and take water. So for the things that we see, you know, blacks, you know, the high numbers of blacks still going to prison, it's not something that surprises us, but it should. And it's horrible that even, you know, with this day and age and with the technology that's been advanced, there still aren't enough efforts being done to help these people. These are the people who, you know, who want to do better. No one wants to be impoverished. No one wants to be on welfare. No one wants to.
Yeah.
Jack, we've got it, and I appreciate your call very much. Margaret Jones, there's a lot we want to put to you there. I mean, you write.
Yeah, I want to thank you so much for calling in, because that is an important thing, too, for people to realize. This isn't just L.A. You know, people leave from L.A., and these gangs are spreading all over. And they're little L.A. set names, I mean, in all different states, in all different cities.
You write in the book, though you were living here in a thoroughly black environment, you say, the first time I heard myself called white, because that was your skin tone, the first time I heard myself called white, I heard it as a powerful insult. Living here, that was South Central, white seemed to mean rich people who didn't understand or care. Jack saying, you know, something else ought to be done. What?
Well, I think we send our kids really powerful messages, especially in the inner cities where, okay, LA Unified Public School, their average class size is something like 27. But Southgate has 55 kids in a class. That's not right. What are you telling those kids, that the white kids in the suburbs mean more than they do? You don't have money for books, but you have money for a metal detector in the school. The kids are going to school in prison. And then at the same time, you're cutting every single program in school, after school programs, arts, music, everything. And you're building prisons. So you're telling the kids that you're going to put money into incarceration instead of education. These kids statistically have a better chance of sitting in a smaller class by going to juvie. That's sad. That's a very sad message to send to a kid. These kids need something to do. They need community centers. We need vocational training in the hood. We need jobs, living wage jobs in the hood. You know, you have mass amounts of people piled together, but there's no jobs.
And 1 in 9 black men aged 20 to 34 in prison. This is not news to you growing up there.
Nah, that's not news. I'm surprised that it's not more. You know, the statistic I grew up hearing was 1 in 3 is in prison or parole. It's a lot of people. And what is so hard is once you get that felony, no one wants to give you a chance. I have a homeboy who just got home off a 15-year shooting case. He's going to college. He's doing everything right. And he has probably filled out 200 job applications, and no one will give him a chance.
See what I mean? I've changed. I'm no longer a playboy on the run. I need something that's stronger. Friendship, trust, honor, respect, admiration. This whole experience has been such a revelation. It's taught me love and how to be a real man.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about growing up in the gangland of South Central L.A., a girl's eye view of the brutality and the tenderness of a very rough world there. Margaret B. Jones is with us. She's author of the new memoir, Love and Consequences, a memoir of hope and survival. Estella is calling from Boston. Hi, Estella. You're on the air with Margaret Jones.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Very well. Thanks, Estella.
I needed a call in. I was driving and I heard the program. This is the first time I call in, but
it's great to have you.
I basically just, I guess I could start by saying I grew up in East Los Angeles. It was a neighborhood called Happy Valley, which was, had its own gangs. I was born in the 60s and I grew up and, with gangs basically surrounding us. My parents, were poor immigrants from Mexico, and my dad did work, but, I relied a lot on my mom. My mom, I recall, tried to scrape whatever money she had together to get us on the bus sometimes and take us out of East Los Angeles. And we'd go to West L.A. or she'd take us to bookstores out there. And even just riding out of East L.A., made me feel like I was going to another world. And my best friend growing up, her whole family, they were all gangs. They were all gang members. And her brothers would get shot up, and she was my best friend since I was born. And yet I remember her family and my family being a little different in that my mother, no matter how poor we were, kept trying to steer us into a different world. And yet we belonged to the community. And, you know, my mother worked at the school.
Mm.
When she could, she'd volunteer. But we were very poor. I remember wearing secondhand clothes and people laughing at us, all three of my sisters and I.
But Estella, are you saying that even in these tough circumstances, a particular family can steer its way out if it's determined enough? Is that you're going?
Definitely, because we were so poor that we could have easily said, you know, I want that. And if my mother would have, you know, keeled over and said, you know, sure, go ahead, I'll get it for you just to fit in, then maybe we would have ended up that way. I'm not sure. I can't tell you for sure, but I just remember her strength. And she died when I was 14.
Estella, stick with us for a second. Margaret Jones, what do you say? If you're only determined enough, you can get out of this. You don't have to be in the gang's grip.
I think it depends. You know, people want to say everybody has choices, and everybody does have choices. Sometimes your choice is steal or starve, and it's a choice, but there's no good choice in the choice. Moms didn't want anybody to join the gang either. You know, she didn't want to watch her kids go to jail or die. I think the older generation knows that, but you have to understand different gangs recruit differently. What goes on in East Los is not the same as what goes on in South Central. Each neighborhood, even in South Central, is completely different from the next. And it depends on that particular kid, too. Maybe for her, like she's saying, she watched how hard her mom worked, and that affected her in a different way. Now, to one child might watch their mom work 2-3 jobs and say, I don't want to watch my mom do this. I'm going to go get money so that we have something and mom doesn't have to do this. Another child might say, I'm not going to join a gang because as hard as my mom works, I don't want to break her heart. So everybody's going to take things differently. You know, we're all individuals. And like I said, there's good and bad in all community. There's all different kinds of people. And everybody has their own way.
Estella, let me ask you, Margaret was saying earlier that in the years since her childhood in South Central, the gang lines have become much more racial than strictly Bloods and Crips, much more black versus Latino. Do you hear that coming out of your hometown, your home neighborhood, Estella?
Well, actually, right now I live in Boston. I moved here. My husband's in dental school, which he also was trying to be. They tried to jump in him into a gang when we lived in El Torino. And actually, I haven't heard much of the neighborhood because I'm out here now. But I could say that my sisters and I all moved out and went to college. And I can understand what Margaret's saying about everyone's going to take it differently. But I honestly could say that she did set an example. Even if I only had her for 14 years, she died shortly after of cancer.
Yeah.
And I see what she's saying, but I do think parents have a lot of power, even if they're poor. If they just put their noses in everything their kids are doing, maybe if everybody ganged up together as adults rather than the gangs, you know, and it's easy. But I'm just thinking of an alternative. If there's a way out of this, it's the parents that can gang up together.
Yeah, Estella, we hear the perspective and we appreciate it. Let me get a call from Valerie in Norfolk, Virginia. Valerie, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, sir. I want to thank your guests for being on board today. I'm in Norfolk, Virginia, as you said, and I just want to know, why do you idolize the gang member that recruited you into the gang? I mean, what's the... I always hear that here's a guy who, you know, he's older, but you're only 12 and he recruits you. But for some reason, even though after he's shot and he dies, that's somebody you still look up to and someone you still idolize. I don't understand that.
Margaret, why with Krasiak, your OG?
Well, idolize is a strong word. I mean, he was someone who... I don't think with the part that I'm reading, you're really understanding what he was. And I don't even think if you read the book, you could understand who he was. And I don't even think if I wrote an entire book just about him, you could understand who he was. But this was a person who was very smart, was very educated, and would sit down with us little kids who no one cared about and give us his time and give us his lessons and his knowledge. And he would sit down and tell us, you know, I briefly alluded to it, but he'd tell us the history of L.A. and L.A. was a place that was mostly white until World War II. And he would say, you know, in World War II, they built the Jordan Downs projects, and they built that solely for black people. Black people were not allowed to own property until the internment of the Japanese. And then Little Tokyo became South Central. Mm. That was the first time people were allowed to own housing. And he was telling us things like this and telling us about jazz on Central Ave and how that was broken up and how white people in the police used to come in and beat on people, and telling us, well, that's why the Slossons and the Purple Hearts and all these people started. They started for this. And at the same time, you have to understand, this is someone who used to say, Bloods and Crips, excuse me, we're not each other's enemies. We just have a conflict with each other, but our social conditions are the same. Nobody wants to be caught up in this violence. It's just hard to get away when it's always personal.
And I have to say, it was a powerful impression made on me by the path you had already taken. You had been in eight homes, including homes where your foster parents just fed you whatever scraps were left over on their plates. I mean, if anyone cared, that must have been a powerful magnet, if anyone cared for you.
Right, and I had teachers who were like, you're a bunch of knucklehead little street punks, you know, teachers who would insult you. And if your teachers don't care about you and nobody else cares about you, and here's a grown person caring about you and trying to teach you something, I mean, that's a real powerful thing to a kid.
Mm. Valerie, thanks for calling. Let's go to Jackson in Beaufort, South Carolina. Jackson, you're on the air.
Yes, listen, I'm definitely going to get the book, but something that's very confusing to me, Ms. Jones was saying that it's gotten to the point where it's almost a race war, and I was wondering how it seems like a contradiction where the very people who are trying to kill you at some point up or down the line, you have to go to those very people to get the crystal meth, the coke, and the drugs that you're selling in the black neighborhood. How does that work? If you understand what I'm trying to say, you're going to the very enemy that you're trying to kill you to get the drugs that you're selling in your neighborhood.
Well, what about it, Margaret Jones? What is the supply line, and who's seen as the enemy, or who's not?
Let me see if I have the question right. You're saying the people who are putting drugs in the community are the people who are the enemy?
Black people do not produce, well, I would say generally.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
You know, that is one of the big ironies, is that you're poisoning your own community. I mean, you are your community's own worst enemy, being in the hood selling drugs. But at the same time, I don't think people are thinking about that. I don't think people are looking at the different – I'm not a conspiracy theorist type person. But, you know, there are many out there talking about it's the CIA and the FBI who put crack cocaine in the hood through the hands of Freeway Rick Ross. And they did come from somewhere. And I think that's very powerful. And now, you know, you have a lot of the Hispanic gangs, MS-13, supplying a lot of the drugs that come in. And it is a very sad thing because the community completely changed with the arrival of crack cocaine. I mean, completely changed.
Why didn't your neighbors, even Krasiak, your OG, why didn't he just get on a bus and get out of there? Start over somewhere else. You know, get out of an environment. Leave the environment where, as you describe it, you almost had no way up or out or to self-respect other than gang and drug life.
Well, first off, you have to understand that L.A. is that place people came to for more opportunity. If you look at someone of the older generations, they came there from the South to give their family more opportunity because people got lynched in the South. Mm-hmm. Now, they came for these urban jobs and everything that they thought their kids would get, and now they're watching their kids basically get lynched in a different way in the streets or go to jail for life. And a lot of the older generation, if you talk to them, they'll tell you, I should have stayed in Alabama. I should have stayed in Mississippi. This did not do anything. But the idea of getting on a bus and going somewhere else, I mean, go where? How is it going to be different? You could go to a rural place that's incredibly racist. You can go to a liberal white place, which is still racist. They just don't tell you to your face. You probably don't have a lot of job training. I mean, you don't feel like life has set you up to just get out on your own. Plus, the day-to-day living in L.A. is so expensive. I mean, I want people to understand that a one-bedroom apartment in L.A., you're paying $1,000 a month. So to work and save money and leave, it just doesn't work.
Let's go to John in Boston. John, you're on the air with Margaret Jones.
Yeah, thank you for having the conversation. I would like to preface my remark by saying in the past I've gotten a lot of support from the Hells Angels and a lot of love from the Latin Kings. So I'm not prejudiced, and I've been in that world. My problem is for Margaret to say that her homeboy did a 15-year bid and now he's looking for a second chance and he's not getting it. He's upset. Did his victim get a second chance? There's a point at which people have to take responsibilities for their own actions, and I know the cards are stacked against people in that, especially in South Central L.A. and in other neighborhoods, but at some point you have to take responsibility for your own actions. Maybe if another person sees that that person can't get a job, they'll think twice before what they do.
Margaret, what do you say to that perspective, John's perspective?
I hear what you're saying. I've lost people in the war, too, but you have to understand that when you join a gang, you understand that you've joined a game that has rules and it has consequences. And if you're joining a gang running around, there's a chance that you will get shot, and you understand that. I think anybody from a gang, if you say, oh, that person shot a civilian, they're going to say, well, that's ridiculous. You don't do that. You don't target civilians. So you're talking about, it's a deadly game, and I'm not condoning in any way. If there was a way I could, you know, touch a button and make it end, I would make it end. If I could be a martyr for the cause and gang violence could die with me, I would take that. But one, you have to understand that he did 15 years from when he was under 18 years old. He lost a huge chunk of his life, and when he did that 15 years, he paid his debt to society. So I don't think it's fair to say, well, the court said you get 15 years and then you get out, but you still have to keep paying. He paid. He paid his debt to society. Two, he killed someone who would have killed him, and actually it was attempted. It was not an actual murder case. Otherwise, he would be on death row. So he attempted homicide on someone who would have surely killed him. I tell people, I don't know that gang-related homicide, you know, they have a separate charge for gang-related homicide than they do for homicide. It's a different charge. And I don't even know that there is such a thing as gang-related homicide. I think there's gang-related self-defense. Now, when I say that, I'm not condoning in any way. It's sad for someone to lose someone, whether they're a Blood, a Crip, a Sereno. It doesn't matter what you are. It's sad. Nobody should be losing people over bandana colors and skin colors. That's ignorant.
Your foster brother, Terrell, who we heard how he was jumped in at age 13, killed, murdered by Crips at 21.
Right. One of my best friend's little brother killed 2 years ago, 16 years old. We just had his 18th birthday, like January 29th. 16 years old. He didn't even get a chance at life. And this was a good kid.
Let's go to Patrick. He's calling from Los Angeles in California. Patrick, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I was a teacher in the inner city, and now for the last few years, I'm a salesperson. I'm a middle-aged white man, and I actually come in from Pasadena, but I go into all the schools in South Central, Compton, and Linwood, and to speak to the change in the violence, the type of gangs now, you could be more of an outsider than I am, but I never feared for myself in neighborhoods that have historically the stronger black gangs, Compton, et cetera, et cetera. But I tell you, the Linwood or the Hispanic gangs in that area, they scare me, they frighten me, because they seem to also not only prey on other gangs, they will prey on outsiders. That's where my real fear comes in. And I think it really speaks to 15 years ago, that was never a fear of mine, and now it clearly is. And I think what Margaret talks about, from an outsider, I sense that every week, every time I walk into those neighborhoods.
That change and the danger growing. Patrick, thanks very much for your call. Margaret, have you seen that dynamic? You're in Eugene, Oregon now, a long way from the old home streets of South Central. You've got a young daughter you're raising in relative peace and calm there. Is it more dangerous back on the home streets or not?
You know, I go home all the time, but it is more dangerous. As I don't want to say we joke around, but we talk and we say, you know, as bad as it was when we were kids, it's worse today. And the thing is, most gangs, most black gangs, I will say, back in the day, or even still today, have very strict, you don't prey on civilians. You're talking one of the biggest gangs in L.A. is the Rolling Twenties. They share a neighborhood with USC. And with the biggest church in South L.A. Now, if you were preying on civilians, I promise you the police would have come in like I don't know what. You can't go after those university students. You know that. And nobody wants to. They mean you no harm. They're not a threat to you. They're not threatening your drug turf. you walk the same streets. You don't interact. You share movie theaters. You share coffee shops.
And live in a different world.
Completely different world.
I should say, for our listeners, you can read an excerpt of Margaret B. Jones's book, Love and Consequences. You can also see at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also see there a slideshow, a video interview, links to Margaret Jones' organization, International Brother Sisterhood, aimed at helping kids out of gangs. Margaret B. Jones, it's a remarkable piece of work you've done here. Very grateful to you for bringing the story forward in such an intimate way for us. Thank you very much, and good luck with everything, with your family, with your writing. I hope you do more of it. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Margaret B. Jones, her new memoir is Love and Consequences. We'll go out with Above the Law. This is Deep as the Root.
Sometimes I can't fight the feeling. See setbacks, they come by the millions. Life is one big escapade. You won't know till it's too late.